This is a Defocus Media production.
Hey, everybody. I'm your four-eyed professor, Chris Levens, and I'm super excited to talk to you today. Our roll call is for new and experienced ODs, optometry students, and even those just interested in this profession. We'll cover a number of topics together, and I'll help you see them through a professor's eyes. Please take your seats. School's in session.
Welcome back, everybody. We are continuing our deep dive into imaging technologies, and I am back with Dr. Jim Williamson from the Memphis VA to continue our discussion about this topic. Welcome back, Jim, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. So, we last kind of talked about the types of OCTs, some of the early histories, and then the discussion of, you know, whether optometrists and ophthalmologists today really do need to employ them. And the answer was, of course, yes. So if it comes to buying a new one, a replacement one, or buying your first one, what are some of the things that we should consider when purchasing?
I think that probably you need to just look at what's your creativity that you want to use with the machine. And let me explain that just a little bit. So you've got machines, and all of them will do the same thing for you. I mean, they're all going to take, you know, RNFL scans. They're all going to do, you know, macular analysis for glaucoma, which obviously is very big. They're all going to do, you know, radio scans and dent scans. But outside of that, you know, do you want to employ your machine any other way? You know, for us specifically, you know, since we got our, you know, unit, you know, 12 years ago, the Spectralis, we've been doing peripheral OCT. So by being able to, you know, maneuver the machine around, are you interested in retina from that standpoint? Do you want to do, you know, OCTs on holes to see if they are truly full thickness? You know, do you want to do, as we talked about in the last podcast, do you want to do mibography, you know, where you're looking at your meibomian glands? Mm-hmm. Most of the machines have anterior segment capability, so that's always going to be something. But just how do you want to use the machine? You know, the IR camera can even measure pupils. So you can do pupils in dark and light. So you can actually take the calipers and measure. And that's a different way to do it versus trying to figure out a system where you're being able to measure pupils in a dark, dark situation. So
right.
It just depends on how creative you want to be with your instrument.
Do I have to consider what type of practice I'm in? If I'm in a bigger glaucoma practice, is that going to lead me one direction versus a retina practice versus an anterior seg practice?
I think it depends on if you go into something, whatever you have there to be consistent where you don't lose data, if I'm answering that correct. So like for us, we started out with a specific unit however many years ago. So we have so much longitudinal data that you would want to be consistent. But whatever you start with, just remember that that's probably what you're going to stick with for a good while if you want to keep that longitudinal data.
Got it. So what you're saying is if I buy an instrument made by company X, and then in 10 years I decide to buy an instrument by company Y, I'm not going to all of a sudden be able to merge that data if these are from two different manufacturers.
Yep, that's exactly right. So that's a challenge, you know. You would go into obviously rebaselining all your glaucoma patients, and you know, there's other things that you have on hand that you would still be able to do, like visual fields and things like that. So would it be the end of the world? No, not necessarily at all. But it would be something to consider, of course.
For you personally, is there some attribute that some current model has that intrigues you more than others?
You know, I've mentioned it a few times, the Spectralis for me, I've been using it for so long. I do like doing peripheral OCTs. And I think that's one thing that doesn't get quote unquote advertised as much. And we see that with lattice degeneration and holes where, you know, we've always, when we do BIO and scleral depression and things like that, we just automatically assume that everything is a full thickness hole if it looks more red. But when you start doing these peripheral OCTs, you start seeing that some of these, what we thought were full thickness holes, aren't really full thickness. They're partial thickness holes. You know, think about lattice degeneration. It's a degeneration, which means you're not going to all of a sudden come up with a full thickness hole overnight. You know, it's going to degenerate. So what stage are you at in that? And also, you know, are you able to really detect how those edges of that hole are? Are they lifted off just a little bit? You know, do we have the scleral depression skills with our new practitioners that we do with practitioners that, you know, were there before the advent of this technology that, you know, acquired those skills because they didn't have anything else? So for me personally, I do like that aspect of that specific device. But it, of course, it depends on, like I said earlier, it depends on where your creativity wants to come from.
All right. So I'm going to touch on three things that you just brought up because they led me there. And so the first one is just, I'm going to get on my soapbox for a moment to talk about scleral depression, because it is a technique that people need to master. And for a human being, it's not something that people typically do and masterfully right out of the gate. It's one of those things that takes time to accentuate this skill for a couple of reasons, from my perspective. Number one, the most peripheral retina is the easiest to depress, but the hardest to view. So you can depress all day, but if you're not viewing in the right spot or out far enough to the periphery, you're going to miss it. And so as your peripheral retina skills improve with your binocular indirect, continue to employ and practice and repractice scleral depression, and it will be invaluable to your practice. Some may say, well, the patients don't like it. It may not be a practice builder, but the globe itself does not have a lot of sensory nerves. It's not pushing on the globe that hurts the patient. Typically, it's pinching the skin against the orbital rim. And so if you're fluent, if you know your patient's anatomy, just, and when I say that, take your thumb and your index finger and push on their anatomy, figure out where that bone is and stay away from the bone. And usually the patient will be able to tolerate this a whole heck of a lot better.
If I could clap right now, although I might clap right now, Chris, you know, that you said it so well. That is so true. And two things just real quick. One is I was actually looking at I think it was a YouTube video of a retinal specialist talking about something, and he went to point to something on a computer screen, and he was using a scleral depressor as a pointer. And so I thought, and that just really struck me. I was like, okay, so here's a retinal specialist that the very first thing that he reaches for to point something out is what he has right next to him, which is a scleral depressor. So that lets me know right away that that's an important tool that that person uses in their everyday practice. And yes, you're exactly right. It's incorrect technique that causes pain. It's when they hit that orbital rim and they don't do it. I thought scleral depression was voodoo during my residency. And, you know, my mentor was under Bill Jones, who wrote one of the books.
That's on right.
peripheral retina. And so he taught me well. And I remember it was October in my residency. I'll never forget it. And I saw something that was interesting. I wasn't sure what it was. I did scleral depression, and it ended up being a flap tear. And the retinal specialist actually called me over, as an optometrist, called me over into a room with three ophthalmology residents that says, this is the optometrist that picked this up. This was a difficult pickup, and he wanted me to look at it. So it's a skill that, and you're right, it's just not being utilized because we aren't practicing it correctly.
Yeah.
I'm going to get out of the soapbox too.
What an amazing story. I actually had the opportunity to work with Bill Jones for a while as well. And boy, was he an inspiring person to try to emulate his technique and abilities. Truly impressive optometrist.
Yeah.
And way ahead of his time. All right. So next one is this. When we first purchased our first OCT, our utilization of fluorescein angiography plummeted. And I'm specifically talking about retinal OCT. But since then, over the last 10 years plus, I've seen OCT still is, you know, has a lot of utilization, but I've seen utilization of fluorescein angiography absolutely creep up at a much higher rate. So why do you think that happened? And why do you think what I've witnessed recently, is that just an enigma to us, or do you think other people have experienced that as well?
No, I think you're right, Chris. I felt the same way too. When OCT first came out, and us over at the VA, we were doing probably, we did it 2 days a week, and we were probably doing 8 each of those 2 days. So 16 a week we were doing. And yeah, it tanked after OCT because some of these simple things like a pigment epithelial detachment or cystoid macular edema after cataract surgery, Irvine gas, we were able to see those non-invasively with an OCT. So, but I think that after a while, you're exactly right. We realized, hey, you know, we're not getting all the information that we need. You know, we're not getting leakage. You know, we're not seeing in the diabetics, we're not seeing where that dye is, what that dye is doing as it goes through the different stages, the early phase, the mid phase, and the late phase, to see what the dynamics of the flow is, to be able to determine, you know, where are those areas where those microorganisms are leaking or not. We were only able to tell sort of a spot sort of assessment versus a longer term flow issue.
Right. All right. Now, the last thing I wanted to bring up is with regards to optic neuropathies. You know, and you mentioned a couple times already, you know, one of the things that optic nerve scans will image is the retinal nerve fiber layer. Pre-OCT technology, that was a layer that through a little bit of luck and a little bit of optimal lighting, we tried to visualize on our own. Is the technology truly better than my own eyes? Should I forget the ability that I have right now to look at it myself and just rely on the OCT, or is there still value in looking at it myself?
Oh man, these are great questions, Chris. So, first of all, if you look at the staging of glaucoma, and I think it's the American Academy or the American Optometric Association staging for glaucoma, and it may be mild stage. I don't go off that stage for grading glaucoma, but it says something about the retinal nerve fiber layer of you grossly looking at it. So it is important for you to grossly look at the nerve fiber layer. The GON project, the grading optic nerve head optic neuropathy project, actually one of their five R's is looking at the retinal R nerve fiber layer. And so if they put that in the project, obviously it's very important to learn and to make sure you maintain that skill. You know, back in the day, we were looking for what we used to call these rake defects, where, you know, you had these, you know, if you took a rake and you took out maybe two of the little teeth in the rake, and then you went back over a, you know, grain of sand or something like that, and you would have these defects in the RNFL. Now, I think it's very important to still look at, because it can actually guide you by looking at it clinically when you're interpreting the OCT to be able to say, hey, look, you know, this dip in the RNFL maybe due to something other than glaucoma, depending on how that defect looks like when you're looking at it clinically.
Fantastic. Yep. All right. So now let's talk about scans. OCT scans. Walk us through your approach to what you do first, what you do second, what you do third, all with the goal to not make mistakes.
Well, I think like everybody else, I think, you know, with EHR, you need to make sure it's the patient that you're looking at.
Right. Absolutely.
So, you know, that way you don't make any mistakes there. Obviously look at quality, you know, make sure you got a quality scan, depending on what machine you're using. Obviously they have quality parameters that are there. You need to know your database. You know, some machines are dummy proof where I think it's on the Zeiss actually that does it, where if something is grayed out on your on one of your reports, it basically tells you that, hey, there's something amiss here. This is outside the normative database range. So I think you need to know the database. You know, if you got a 95-year-old and you're doing an RNFL scan on, well, that person wasn't probably in any database included.
Right.
Conversely, you know, if you have an 8-year-old and you're doing an RNFL scan on and you're saying, oh, wow, this 8-year-old is outside the normative range, well, they probably also weren't included in the database. You need to look at that. Segmentation errors is huge. So if you're doing an OCT, obviously you're seeing some pathology, hopefully, or something clinically that you're seeing it's amiss. You know, does the machine segment right? You know, what that means is it detecting the different layers of the retina accurately? When you get pathology, you're going to get, you know, sort of a broken record, so to speak, where the machine may get confused on where that, you know, outer nuclear layer, outer plexiform layer is, and give you some erroneous data because it's not segmenting correctly. And I think that's probably, you know, probably the most important things other than what we touched on, you know, previously, which is Green disease. you know, just making sure you just don't look at that color and saying, hey, this is green, it's clean, versus really, you know, looking at this can and doing a doctor's interpretation of what's going on.
Yeah, I don't know if it's just, would you agree, you know, it is understandable why companies would use red, yellow, green as alerts for us, because, you know, that's something that we see every day when driving, but does it give us an artificial crutch to lead us in a specific direction? And then in some patients confuse us because it's led us in a misdirection.
Yeah, it's, I don't like the green, yellow, red, but I understand it because it sort of makes things easy. Because if I wanted to be a practitioner that was quote unquote, maybe more lazy, then I would just look at green and say, like I said before, you know, green is clean. Oh, great. You know, we're good. Perfect. Go on. I wouldn't have to delve into the case and really look, are there segmentation errors, you know, in a myope, you know, myopes, their humps on the RNFL tend to be shifted more temporally, which can give you artificial thinning, you know, versus a hyperopes, their humps are tempted are shifted more nasally. And so it can also artifactually give you thinning there. So I may look at that and say, oh, they are red, they have glaucoma. But if I further look into the, you know, what's going on with the machine and how it's scanning the patient's anatomy, I can catch these things. So, you know, green disease and also red disease, where red disease may not be true because of the way those vessels exit the disc and those different refractive errors.
You alluded to earlier an article that that you suggested for everybody to read by Chen and Carden, Avoiding Clinical Misinterpretation Artifacts of Optical Coherence Tomography Analysis of the Optic Nerve, Retinal Nerve Fiber Layer, and Ganglion Cell Layer. As a reference to that, guides us through some of the mistakes that can be easily be made and how to avoid them. But when it comes to things like a instrument that you have acquired, their normative database, how does one go about deciphering, well, what races were tested, what age groups were tested based on a certain disease path? How do we decipher that and uncover that?
It's that's the challenge that we all have. You know, you can look on the company's at least for us, you can look on the company's website, download their all their data, and they'll tell you what their mix was. Some of the machines will actually tell you that this was only valid for Caucasians. But even when you look at the normative database, it's interesting. You know, there might be three people from a certain race that are in that normative database. So you're just comparing your patient, if they're that specific race, to three other people. So you sort of want to take your mindset out of, you know, event analysis, where you're analyzing things that day, and shift yourself more to a trend analysis, where you're taking a capture that day image, and then you're looking at change over time with that specific patient. And by doing so, you sort of bypass that normative database thing, because you're not saying, okay, this specific day in relationship to that database reference. No, I'm going to now say I've got, you know, 5 years of data on this specific patient from day one, and I can see how they have specifically changed over the course of time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are there any specific company resources that you're aware of based on brands of OCTs that have caught your attention?
Yeah, you know, Heidelberg has their Business Lounge website. You can download a bunch of stuff on. OptiView has their academy. They call it the OptiView Academy. Zeiss has My Zeiss. And they'll have some information for you there to be able to download and look through. And that's very helpful.
All right. So let's transition into ultra wide field imaging. What are your thoughts there?
You know, I think ultra wide field imaging for me, and honestly, I was listening to Jay Haney. He's in the Optometric Retina Society with me. He's out of Seattle. And I don't think still to this day that they have ultra wide field imaging. And he's in a retina practice that may have changed over the last year, but not everybody has it. But for me, I've only been in the ultra wide field for about a year. And I would say the most important thing for me is reminding me of that, Jerry Cavallaro. Of course, I only mentioned him because he's an OD, that article that was out, you know, 5 or 6 years ago that talked about how if you have predominantly peripheral lesions or PPLs, they call them, in diabetics, that you are, you know, around a 4 times greater risk of developing proliferative diabetic retinopathy. And I think that's where ultra-wide field imaging for me has been good, where, you know, if you're looking just in the posterior pole and you're seeing basically maybe a microaneurysm or two, but then you do an ultra-wide field imaging and you're really seeing that ability to capture these intraretinal hemorrhages in the mid periphery that may be more significant than what you're seeing in the posterior pole, that sort of sets you in a different mindset for following that diabetic patient to say, hey, look, this patient might be at greater risk of developing proliferative disease versus me just looking at the posterior pole and saying, yeah, you got one microaneurysm, you're mild, your risk is low, we'll see you back in X amount of time.
So when do you do when do you employ ultra wide field imaging versus, and do you do it with OCT or without OCT or independent of both?
So for me, I think that mostly when we employ it is more of a documentation standpoint. You got to remember, like you, Chris, I'm more old school. So I'm going to take my BIO. Some of these ultra wide field capabilities, and I definitely don't want to down any of them whatsoever, but they sort of forget, you know, about the inferior retina and because of the lash issue. So you're not even getting out to equator sometimes in some of these modalities. And so you still need to dilate these patients and make sure that you're looking clinically at these things. But for a documentation standpoint, I think it's great. Education standpoint from the patients that you can show them these things. And of course, you know, not all patients are going to want to dilate on that visit where you need to at least get something documented. I think that's a great tool to be able to use this ultra wide field imaging modality.
A lot of practices right now are, and for very good reason, opening with a specialization in anterior seg and with a specialization into complicated corneas that lead them to scleral lens fits. So that's a highly specialized part of the eye. It's a highly specialized talent. If you were a practitioner and that was your bailiwick, what might you utilize to assist you in examining the rest of the eye, given that a lot of your focus was on the extreme anterior edge of the eye?
Well, I do know this, and you hit on one of my addictions lately, is scleral lenses. I'm a disease guy, but I've been really working hard at my scleral fits. So I'm actually up to date on this topic, believe it or not. So yeah, some machines will allow you to measure on your say your scleral fits, you can actually measure central corneal clearance using calipers. But some machines, you know, don't allow you to measure, like the Spectralis, you can't actually measure using calipers different distances. You know, you can visualize it, but the optic view, for instance, and I think the Spectralis or the Zeiss machine will also let you do that, where you can actually measure these parameters. You know, on the flip side of that too, though, some of these experts say after a while they sort of get away from using OCT on these kinds of things. So yeah, it's great in the beginning, and then after a while you may shift away from that. You know, another interesting thing, I just pulled an article that was talking about how when you're looking at these scleral fits, that what you're seeing actually may not be entirely accurate because you're going through two refractive indices, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Very. All right, the last thing I want to touch on with you in our talk is, and it's only relevant to me because of time, in that we just recently got out of the Optometric Glaucoma Society meeting and spent a lot of time talking about the optic nerve. You've examined optic nerves pre-OCT and imaging technologies and post-OCT and imaging technologies. What do you think the world would be like for optic nerve analyses today in 2021 if we never have these things at our disposal versus having them at our disposal? Have we become weaker at observing minor anatomic changes visually?
Yes, and I know you know that too, Chris. And it's well documented that, you know, people don't do well at grading optic nerves. You know, inter-observer variation is just too high. I think for me, the best thing that's happened with OCT is probably ocular hypertensives, where you're able to look at a patient where their pressure is X, but yet you do that the nerve fiber layer, you see a robust NFL, the ganglion cells are symmetrical. And I think that that's probably one of the areas for me that's been good to have the technology to be able to make sure that everything is where we want it to be in those patients.
All right, so the floor is yours. We will wrap it up with whatever you have to say regarding, let's say, an established practitioner wants to be able to do more with their technology at their disposal. What's the one piece of advice you would give them to utilize their instrumentation at a higher level than they're using it today?
Like I said before, just be creative. You can use your machine in so many different ways. And then also make sure that you make some effort to learning the machine, reading the manual, learning the database, knowing how to interpret scans, looking at segmentation errors. Don't just look at reports and make blanket decisions. And just remember, OCT is part of multimodal imaging, which is the big buzzword, as you know, Chris, from everything that we do. OCT is just one piece of the puzzle. So you could have, you know, you need to look at still visual fields. You look OCT, all these other things. Clinically, you need to look at it. You know, so don't rely just on one piece of instrumentation to overtake your clinical decision making.
Fantastic. Thank you, Dr. Williamson, for joining us to talk in this deep dive of OCT and imaging technologies. Hopefully you and I can come up with some topics to discuss in the future, but it definitely was our pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
Class is ended for today, and we have no exams or grades approaching. Please email me at foureyedprofessor@gmail.com if there are topics that you would like to hear and see through a professor's eyes.